and he's going to tell us about his first attempt on the $1 million.
Well, you can tell me whether I deserve the money or not, I guess. It's a pleasure to be here, of course. I'm going to tell you today about some work that I've been doing. George Minich from Virginia Tech for almost a couple of years now, and Alexander Yelnikov, a postdoc at Virginia Tech, has joined us in the last year. We're concerned with Curie-Engels theory, and solving Curie-Engels theory in a certain sense. As many of you know, there was a very short paper that we put out in December in which we gave some of our main results, and we promised a much longer version which would actually explain what we were talking about, and that's still to be announced, but it will, I hope, appear within the next few weeks. So hopefully in this talk I'll be able to explain many of the things that were in that short paper, and I certainly welcome any questions from the audience as we go along. Well, of course, solving Yang-Mills theory is one of the greatest problems in theoretical physics, and it's something we would all very much like to do, particularly if there's money involved. And it's been long suspected that if a solution of the theory was to be found, it would be in the large n limit for a variety of reasons. A very basic problem in solving QCD, or in solving Yang-Mills theory, is that the way that we formulate the theory in terms of weakly coupled gauge fields, it's clear that those degrees of freedom are not the physical degrees of freedom. They're not the fields that create gauge invariant particle states. And we need to find some sort of formalism in which that sort of thing is more manifest. So as I say here, a basic problem and this theory is identifying important degrees of freedom, and there have been many attempts over the years, both analytically as well as numerically, in trying to do just that, with more or less, well, with some success here and there. But even more importantly, if you think you have identified the important degrees of freedom in the theory, the real question is, can you write the theory in a tractable way and pull out of physical predictions from the theory? Okay, so both of those are very difficult problems. And another problem that we have to address, or another feature of this theory, is that it's very rich. Of course, in a large momentum regime, we know that the theory is asymptotically free, and so that physics should be reflected in whatever we do. But of course, at low energies, the theory is expected to confine. Of course, we're looking for signals of that physics as well. Okay, so if we're trying to find a solution to the theory, then there are a number of things that we would like to demonstrate. As I said, we'd like to find a set of useful variables. We'd like to understand something about the real vacuum of the theory. And this is one of the things that I will argue that we now have a pretty good handle on, particularly at large end. People often refer to this as the master field. I won't really use that, although I won't really use that sort of language here. We'll just talk about the vacuum wave functional in a certain set of written in a certain set of variables. And in addition to those things, we would like to demonstrate observable consequences. We'd like to see the standard signals of confinement. For example, in the expectation value of the Wilson loop, we'd like to see an area law emerging with a string tension and the spectrum of the theory, spectrum of gauge invariant states. The theory is expected to display a mass gap consistent with confinement. So we'd like to see all of those things. And in addition, in Curie-Engels theory, we'd like to compute, if we can, the spectrum of the gauge invariant states, which I'll generically refer to as blue balls here. Okay, so let me give you an outline of this talk, the way I've organized this talk. I'm going to start with some introductory remarks just to get ourselves oriented. And then what I'll do is I'll display for you some. I'll display for you the experiment. What I'll call the experimental data for 2+1 Yang Mills. You might be puzzled by that because, of course, it's difficult to study 2+1 Yang Mills directly. So, of course, what I mean by experimental is a series of lattice simulations of the theory. And as far as I understand, these lattice studies are quite good. They're quite reliable, and they have they've given values of the masses of the Blumenthal states, at least for low-lying states, which I'm told are supposed to be quite reliable. Okay, and then I will, once I show you the lattice results, I'll give you a preview of our analytic results. I'll compare our results to that experimental data. And following that, I'll try to explain how we got to that point. So we'll go, and well, everything that I'm going to say today will be presented in a Hamiltonian formalism. So in 2+1 dimensions, we're going to work in a Hamiltonian formalism in two spatial dimensions within a certain parameterization of the fields, which was pioneered by Caravalli and Nair starting around 1995. And it turns out that these variables are very useful in this regard. So as I said, we're working in a Hamiltonian formalism, so the relevant sorts of things that we want to compute then are the wave functions of various states in the theory. And what we'll focus on here is the vacuum wave functional, the wave functional of the ground state of the theory. And the idea is that if we know sufficiently well what that wave functional is, we can use it, again, within the Hamiltonian formalism, to derive information about the correlation functions of the theory, and hence work out what the masses of gauge invariant states are that would propagate in those correlation functions. Okay, so once we're done, once I've done that, which is basically, as I said, just getting up to this some tables which list our analytic results, I'll then make some comments on the physics of Yang Mills, which emerges from knowledge of this spectrum, and I'll show you that there's some features of this spectrum which seem to be manifestations of the QCD string. And then I'll finish up with some outlook and some additional problems that we're planning and working on in the near future. Okay, so let's begin by reviewing some QCD basics or pure Yang Mills. Basics, of course, you can define the theory by writing down the path interval over gauge fields. I'm always going to be talking here about a gauge group SUN, and we're going to be talking about the large N limit for reasons which I will elucidate as we go on. And the box on the right here is some notation if you need it. And of course, the Yang-Mills action is just the trace of field strength squared divided by 1 over G Yang Mills squared. And we're going to be primarily interested in two dimensions here. And in two dimensions, two spatial dimensions, G Yang Mills squared has the units of mass. It's just its canonical dimension. And consequently, it's often convenient to define a mass scale of G squared then, which is G squared N. Conventionally, we divide that by 2 pi. And that, you'll notice, is just essentially what we might call the Hund coupling, G squared N, up to those pi's. And this scale is the basic mass scale in the theory. Okay. And we should really think about that as a bare mass scale. It's not clear that it's directly related to features of the spectrum of the theory, the Blumenthal spectrum, but we'd expect that it will sort of set the scale for such states, for such masses. So this feature of this theory means that it's a theory which is conceptually different than 3+1, where the Barry-Angles coupling is, of course, dimensionless. In that theory, in 3+1 dimensions, of course, a mass scale in the confining theory has to be generated dynamically. And we understand, at least, you know, at the perturbative level, how that happens. But other than that feature, the two-dimensional theory is really quite similar to the three-dimensional theory, in the sense of they both display asymptotic freedom at large momenta, and they're expected to be confining at low momentum. Okay, so the idea of studying this theory, well, there's several reasons for studying this theory instead of jumping directly to 3 plus 1. One is, in fact, these statements here, that it really is believed to be quite similar to the 3 plus 1 dimensional theory. And of course, the other reason is that at the same time, it's a similar theory, and so we might hope to go further with this than the 3 plus 1 dimensional. At the end of the talk, I'll make some brief comments about perhaps going up to 3 plus 1 dimensions, but that would be somewhat speculative. Okay, so just continuing on with the introductory material. As we said, of course, at short distances, we expect asymptotic freedom, so the theory should go over to a free theory, or approximately free theory, at high energies. This is the perturbative regime of free gluons. Whereas, at the same time, at long distances, we should expect to see confinement. And as we said, this will be manifested by generation of a mass gap, no massless excitations in the spectrum, even though that's what it looks like at infinitely high momentums. And as I said over and over, we hope to compute the spectrum of the Eigenvariant states. Okay. So some very basic phenomenology, of course, is the flux tube picture of the forces between color charges. And we have, you know, we've often hoped that there would be some string theory description of QCD. And of course, that was the origin of the fundamental string theory. But I just, well, as I said, I'm going to get back to some comments about the QCD string that seems to emerge from this work. But one comment that I want to make at the beginning is that we don't really expect this string theory, this QCD string theory, to be precisely like the free string. And one basic reason for that is this asymptotically free regime. So this would-be string theory has to know about all of this physics, not just the confining physics that happens at low energies. And, well, later on, to jump ahead a little bit, later on when we talk about that QCD string, we'll see how, in certain regimes, the theory looks like is reminiscent of a free string, but we'll also be able to see where it departs from features of the free string. Okay, well, let me just give sort of a historical survey of some important results from the last 20, 30 years or so. Of course, there's a huge body of work on these topics. I'll just touch upon a few. One very inspiring work was by Te Hoogt in the 1970s in the context of 1 plus 1 QCD, and he showed directly by some Feynman diagram computations at large n that the theory confined. The polar quark propagator moved off to infinity, and there were poles appearing in multi-quark channels. Okay, and this was extended, of course, in the familiar work of Witten in the Fourier angles case, Euclidean case. You can formulate theory on a Riemann surface, and the partition function of that theory can be written down directly as a sum over certain things. And famous work by Gross and Taylor reinterpreted that as term by term as a contribution to the QCD string theory. So for many years, this was really our tightest handle on the relationship between string theory, QCD string theory, and QCD, although it's in this very much simplified 1 plus 1 dimensional model, which, of course, has essentially just topological degrees of freedom. And so for many years, all of us have wanted to extend this to higher dimensions. Okay, well, there is also some very nice work on 2+1 dimensional theories. Paul Yakov, again, in the 70s, looked at lattice compact QED and showed directly that you could think about confinement in that theory through the condensation of magnetic monopoles. It is sort of the well-known dual superconductor point of view for confinement. And he extended this to the Georgi-Glashow model as well, with similar results. And in the case of the Puri-Yang-Mills theory, Feynman in 81 argued that, well, he basically argued that the theory should confine. And the basic idea there was sort of a very general analysis by looking at the Schrodinger equation for the theory and thinking about what wave functions would look like. He argued that you should get a mass gap consistent with confinement, essentially because the configuration space becomes compact in the non-Abelian case. And some of the details of his analysis are apparently incorrect, but the general features here seem to be most certainly true. And of course, there are other more recent examples that don't need any introduction to a stringy audience. Seibert-Witten theory, which had interesting things to say about confinement and confirmed many of these ideas that were developed in these simpler contexts. And of course, the ADS-D of T can also be thought of as a manifestation of QCD circle, or an implementation of QCD circle. Okay, so let's talk about 2+1 Puri-Yang-Mills theory. And as I said, there's a set of experimental data out there in the literature from lattice simulations. And this is largely due to Mike Tepper, who's a lattice theorist at Oxford. And what he has done over the last, eight or nine years, there's a number of papers beginning, I guess, in 98. What I've done here is I pulled a table from one of his papers, which lists the results of calculations for different gauge groups, SU2, SU3, SU4, etc. And he's giving you here numbers for various blue ball states. Okay, and all in units of the square root of the string tension, which can also be computed in the lattice as well as analytically, as I'll show you later. And I will also later explain to you precisely what's meant by this notation here. But these are JPC quantum numbers of various states. Okay, so these numbers, he generates a list of numbers, and some of them are quite accurately known, apparently, at least he seems to think so. And so what's happening here is that it's fairly easy on the lattice to compute masses for low values of n. As you go up in n, it gets harder and harder. But what Tepper shows is that these masses asymptote very rapidly to some fixed numbers. You can see that. You can see this happening in the table. These numbers are converging to numbers later. So I'll show you a table in a moment where those asymptotic numbers are given. Okay, so you can think of the idea is you can think of Tepper's computations as giving you, and he actually presents it this way, as giving you values of blue ball masses in the large n limit by this extrapolation procedure. And as I said, these lattice computations are believed to be quite accurate, and they seem to be able to take a continuum limit of all of that very nicely. I should also say that I'm not showing all of the data here. It's just a subset, and at least for low values of n, SU2, SU3, there is additional information on some of the higher spin states.
Sorry, concerning the accuracy, isn't there a problem for IG? Because in the lattice, you have only discrete rotation. So usually you can't differentiate the mode.
Right.
Up to 4. So what they call 2 in lattice is always a mixture of upwards of 2.8 and
right.
so on. So
right.
U is reliable only for low
genetic. Right. Yeah, if you look at the Tepper paper, he makes a big deal of this. First, a very basic point that that of course the lattice only has a discrete symmetry, and you should you might hope that in the continuum limit you see things separating into definite spin states. But there is, yeah, so there, that's one of the hard parts of the lattice simulation is really separating these states. And we've begun to actually, we hope to begin a discussion, a detailed discussion with Tepper in, comparing our data to his data. And there are a few places here and there where, it looks like the data would fit a little bit better if, this number actually should have been up in this column rather than in that column. So, things, you do have to ask whether things should be, whether things really are sufficiently well separated. But we'll take it at face value for our purposes at the moment. Okay, so here I'm just showing. Can you see this? Okay, so I just ripped some tables out of our short paper and displaying them here. So this is what we've done here is display our results versus the lattice data in this column. Here's our data here. This is for blue ball states which have spacetime quantum number 0++, and in the second table, similar results for 0 minus minus states. And I guess the easiest thing to think about here is to look in the last column, which is the percent difference between our prediction and the lattice data. Okay. And you can see here that the lowest lying state, the lowest lying 0++ state, agrees within less than a percent with the lattice data. And as you go up to these higher 0++ resonances, it looks like they're off of the lattice data by as much as 12 or 15%. And I think one thing that we should point out here is that precisely these masses for these resonances of 0++, they have actually been criticized in the literature that perhaps the error bars, the error bars in the lattice computation should really be larger for some of the reasons perhaps that we were discussing a moment ago. And so it's possible that although these numbers look as much as 12 or 15% off, perhaps it's not as bad as it looks. If you look at the 0 minus minus data, on the other hand, the predictions are within a few percent of the lattice data. The other thing that I've listed here, since there are string theorists in the audience who know all about ABS-CFT, I've listed the corresponding supergravity results using ABS-CFT to estimate the blue ball masses. And for example, in 0 minus minus, you can see that we're significantly closer to the lattice data than we have those supergravity results.
Is it understood why minus minus blue balls did better than plus? You said in some papers it's being criticized, so what makes those more special?
I haven't completely sorted out what those arguments are and whether or not I completely believe them. But I think one of the features is that I think it's just a matter of the fact that these have negative parity. There's probably more things for these states to mix with, and they might be harder to separate. But beyond that, I'm not sure. Now, I don't know. I don't have any reason why. Let me just leave this back. As far as I know, that's it. We also have, we also have data that we didn't show in the short paper, and we will show in this longer paper that we're writing on higher spin states. And in that case, analytically, we have many of the same problems that you would have on the lattice in separating states, because there are various things that can sort of interfere with one another, and you have to worry about whether or not you're really separating states accurately, but anyway, so we have some preliminary results of this higher spin space as well. Okay, so those are the results, and I think the thing that I want you to appreciate here is that we really aren't doing very well, right? These numbers seem to agree very well with the latest data, and so if you learn nothing from this talk, I hope that you learn that we must be doing something. Okay, we didn't just, you know, there's a set of numbers here, and they weren't just randomly generated. We actually got them to honestly agree quite well. So in the rest of the talk, I'd like to explain how these computations were done. Okay, so we're going to look at 2 plus 1 Yang mills in the Hamiltonian formula. And so, of course, the Yang mills Hamiltonian has this form, basically E squared plus B squared, put in the gauge couplings as appropriate, and I've written the E squared term as pi squared, recognizing that the electric field is canonically conjugate to the ordinary gauge fields A. So we're going to work in this Hamiltonian formalism in the, what you might call the Hamiltonian gauge, A0 equals 0. And that leaves behind 2 gauge fields, which we'll take complex linear combinations of those and refer to them as A and A bar. Okay? And we'll work in the complex spatial basis for the spatial coordinates as well. Okay, so in this Hamiltonian formalism, the way that you would think about this as a quantum system is you would have, well, this would be the Hamiltonian, and you would have wave functionals, which in position representation would be functionals of A and A bar. Okay, and we would quantize by replacing this field pi, the electric field, by derivatives with respect to those coordinates. Okay, well, there are, of course, gauge transformations which leave all of this invariant. And if we just consider time-independent gauge transformations, they leave this gauge condition alone. And they act on A and A bar as follows. Right? Because A is a connection, A and A bar is a connection for SUN. And Gauss's law implies, as usual, that any observables, physical states, what have you, should be gauge invariant. Well, it's hard to deal with this gauge fixing because of global effects, et cetera, which I won't get into detail in that because I don't think it's relevant to the talk. But the basic idea that we would like to implement here is to change variables in some way to replace these gauge non-invariant fields by a set of variables that are gauge invariant. Traditionally, and sort of just rewrite the entire theory in those variables and try to make headway by directly using those variables. Traditionally, this is taken to mean, this procedure is taken to mean that we should rewrite the theory in terms of Wilson loops. Okay, so what would we do if we tried to implement that? Basically, or at least heuristically, formally, we want to change variables to these gauge invariant variables. I'll generically call them phi on this slide. And you can imagine the path integral of the theory would transform by a Jacobian factor from the A variables to the phi variables. And typically, this is where one runs into trouble because this Jacobian is very hard to compute. We'll see that in the variables that we'll use this later in the talk, it's actually possible to exactly compute this Jacobian. But in the case of the Wilson loops, it's not known directly. So as I said, a natural choice is to take the variables to be Wilson loops. One of the reasons that that's a very nice choice is that the expectation value of the Wilson loop is an order predictor for confinement. Okay, if in a confining theory, you expect that the expectation value goes like e to the minus sigma times the area subtended by the loop, where sigma has the interpretation of the string tension. Okay, so that from that point of view, the Wilson loop is a very important operator. So the Wilson loop won't go away. We certainly will be interested in computing that object, but we won't formulate the theory directly in terms of the loop. Okay, but continuing along this line, the Wilson loops are believed to be a complete set of operators, but it's, you know, it's clearly an overcomplete set. But at large n, they become essentially independent due to large n factorization features. Okay? And well, these, if you just barge ahead and write the theory down, the equation of motion for these loop variables is a loop equation, and it becomes very hard to proceed. There are very severe regularization problems, conceptual problems, etc. And so that's the point. That's one of the points of this talk, is that although this sort of idea about writing the theory in terms of the agent-invariant variables is a very important and fundamental thing to consider, there might be other variables. There are other variables in this theory that are much nicer from the point of view of these problems that we're trying to refer to here. Okay, so again, if we just continue along with this line of reasoning, you can formally write down, you can go to this description where the Wilson loops are the degrees of freedom, and you can write a Hamiltonian formally in those variables. And the Hamiltonian has a form which is often referred to as the collective field form, not in this context, but in the context of the variables that we'll talk about in this talk. I'll show you precisely what I mean by that later, because I don't want to be familiar. And the idea here would be, again, formally, this was described by Sakita in the early 80s, for example. If you knew how to do this, if you knew what the Jacobian of this transformation was, and you could imagine at least doing some sort of saddle point approximation, and perhaps compute through, and the saddle point approximation was supposed to be equivalent to the large n approximation. Okay, so this, as I said, this process, this logic is what we're essentially going to carry out, but in a more convenient parameterization.
Just a question about that. I mean, in lattice theory, which is the only definition that we have a strong coupling of attributively, we believe we know we have a useful measure, which is the Haar measure. And we don't worry about Jacobian there. We just assume that the Haar measure is the right measure. Mm-hmm. So why?
In this context, actually, the way that these people said it was that although they didn't know how to compute the measure, they could deduce what it had to be essentially by requiring that the Hamiltonian was Hermitian. And for some things, it wasn't really important to know the precise form of it. Well, would you do that? Would you do it very non-local? Oh, yes.
Anyway, go ahead. Since you want to do something else, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll show, as I said, in the formalism that I'll discuss here, we do know the exact form of the Jacobian. Now, I don't really use it in very much detail, but it is important to know it at the level of being confident that the wave functions that I write down can be normalizable in that picture. That can be demonstrated. Okay, so the details, it doesn't matter too much. So maybe I'm overselling that. It's perhaps not that crucial. Okay, so it turns out that there is a parameterization of this theory, which was, as I said, pioneered by Caramalli and Nair, starting in around 1995. And what they did is they took in this Hamiltonian formalism, in the A0 equals 0 gauge, they reparameterized the gauge fields A and A bar in this way. Okay, remember, I'm in a complex basis for the spatial coordinates, so del and del bar are d by dz and d by dz bar. And M here is a complex n by n matrix, which is invertible and unimodular. And, you can do this for reparameterization. You might think that this looks pure gauge, but that would be true if n was unitary, and it is not. Okay, so this is not a is not a pure gauge. One of the nice features of this parameterization is that M transforms linearly under gauge transformations, just by left multiplication, where G is the element of SUN. And so in terms of this variable M, then, it's very easy to find a gauge invariant variable, which we call H, to construct just as M dagger M. Okay. So it's important to realize that H, as I said, is gauge invariant because G is unitary. And this is a local field. So if you like, you can, as I say here, you can think about M as roughly analogous to an open Wilson line and H being a closed loop. That sort of reasoning is useful to you. If we look at the Wilson loop variable, with a spatial Wilson loop, which I've written down here, and translate it into these new variables, we find that it's a path order trace of a polymorphic loop interval in this parameterization of del H inverse. Okay, so this is just an exact translation given the parameterization. Okay? So the idea is that the Wilson loop, part of the complication of dealing with Wilson loop operators is that you have to worry that this depends functionally on the loop that you choose. And from this point of view, it looks like it's sort of an artifact. We don't have to use these variables in order to get something which is locally gauge invariant. We can use H instead and then compute for any given loop. You can compute this object. Okay, but as I said earlier, we're not going to discard the Wilson loop entirely because it will be useful as an order parameter. Okay, so we'll come back to that. Okay, there's a very important feature of this theory, which comes about as a property of this parameterization, which I will refer to as holomorphic invariance. And the way that this comes about is that one could very well wonder whether this parameterization that we've written down is well defined. For example, is it a one-to-one change in variables, et cetera? Does this gauge invariant variable H really capture, is it really capable of capturing all the physics? And in fact, what you find is that there's an extra invariance in this theory which acts as right multiplication on M. As long as, well, it acts as right multiplication by an n by n matrix, which I call H, as long as that matrix depends, as long as the matrix elements depend holomorphically on the coordinates. Let me go back to this formula here, and you can see that if I guess it's maybe easier to look at A bar, if I multiply on the, if I multiply M dagger on the left by H of Z, when I said right multiplication, I was referring to M. M dagger is left multiplication by H of Z. You can see that if I multiply M dagger by H of Z on the left, it just because it's holomorphic, it factors through the derivative, and consequently A bar is just invariant. A similar comment is true about A because M is transforming by an anti-holomorphic factor. Okay, so this is an invariance which is just not present as an action on the original gauge field, but we certainly have to take it into account if we're going to describe the theory in terms of these M variables or the H variables. And you can see here that if you just compute how this acts on H, it just, H gets conjugated left and right by H and H dagger respectively. Okay, you can understand this, the appearance of this extra symmetry by thinking about taking the parameterization that we wrote down and trying to invert it. And when you go through that process, you find that that it's ambiguous, that you couldn't, if you find an inversion of those formulas, there's an equally good inversion where you multiply this expression on the right by some, in this case, an anti-holomorphic matrix. So that's the reason that symmetry is there. And again, it should be, I hope it's clear that this is not some remnant of the gauge symmetry. This is something that the gauge nodes just don't see. It's a new symmetry of this parameterization, a new local symmetry. Okay, so what one should do then in this parameterization, when we write down anything that we write down physically, should be invariant. Any physical quantity should be invariant under this holomorphic transformation. Okay. Now, of course, changing variables, at least classically, isn't very remarkable, but in the full quantum theory, we would like to know, module of the conversation that I had with Lee a moment ago, we would like to know the Jacobian of the transformation. And in this case, it can be worked out precisely. What happens is that, by DMUC, I mean the original measure of the A fields, it can be written in terms of the natural measure on these H fields. Well, it's, if you work it out, the measure is the measure of the H fields times a certain determinant, which looks like a two-dimensional determinant, and that determinant was worked out years ago by Polyakov and Weigmann, for example, and it can be written down just as the exponential of the Wessonino-Witten action. Okay, so the claim is that this Jacobian factor has been robustly calculated. And this Jacobian, as expected, is, well, since we're writing it in terms of gauge invariant variables, we won't be surprised that it's gauge invariant, but it's also holomorphic invariant with respect to this new symmetry that I talked about in the last transparency, as it should be. And consequently, if you think about the Hamiltonian formalism, then if we wanted to compute the quantum overlap of two states, one and two, what we would do is we would write down an integral, and in these new variables, which are written as h, in terms of h, we would have an expression for such an overlap of that form where psi 1 and psi 2 are the position space representatives of those states, and we have a non-trivial measure here, which involves this Wessonino-Witten action. Okay, this non-trivial measure has very important consequences. For example, if we just took the norm of a wave function 1, a constant wave function, we would find that that such a wave function is normalizable if this norm. And we would just get this expression here, and that integral is well, it can be regarded as a partition function of the two-dimensional Wessonino-Witten model, and it's at least for n not equal to 0, at least for the for any non-abelian case, this is up to regularization effects, this is a finite number. Okay, so up to regularization, point splitting issues, things like that, psi equals 1 would be normalizable. And as I'll show you in a moment, psi equals 1 can be thought of as an approximation to the true ground state wave function of the theory. It's not, well, I'll show you, this is not the right wave function for the ground state, but you can think about it as being built from that very simple statement. So this is really where the Jacobian comes into the argument. The Jacobian has a certain form. It allows me to state that a given wave function is normalizable. Okay, well, it turns out that for a number of reasons, a number of reasons, it's convenient to introduce what I'll often refer to as a current variable, J, which is proportional to del HH inverse. And you remember that del HH inverse was the quantity that appeared in the exponential in the expression for the Wilson loop. So from that point of view, it's natural to introduce that variable. And in fact, this J variable has an interesting interpretation. In fact, if you consider a holomorphic transformation, J transforms like a connection for that transformation. I've written it here on the right-hand side. It's purely holomorphic. It's a purely holomorphic transformation. Okay. In terms of this variable J, one can write down one can rewrite the Hamiltonian of the theory, and this was done by Caravalli and Nair. so I'll refer to it as HKM, as, well, as a functional involving factors of J and derivatives with respect to J. And this Hamiltonian, as I alluded to a few slides ago, this Hamiltonian has a form which is reminiscent of the collective field form. Essentially, that just means that it's a simple Hamiltonian which has stuff times double by del J plus stuff times the second derivative with respect to J plus a functional of J. If you sort back through, I should mention throughout this talk, throughout the talk, there are regularization issues which I'm not going to bring to the forefront, but it's certainly important to regulate the theory carefully. And such a technique was introduced by Garibaldi and Nair. It's essentially a covariant point splitting technique. And so that is just in the background behind the slides, if you like, everywhere here. So in deriving this Hamiltonian, that was an important, it was important to do that carefully. If you trace back where these various terms come from, remember the Hamiltonian in the A variables look like E squared plus B squared. You can think of the E squared term as the kinetic term and B squared as a potential. And the Garibaldi-Nair Hamiltonian retains that form. In fact, the last term here, which just involves del bar J, comes precisely from the B squared term in the Hamiltonian. And the thing in parentheses here is the kinetic term, came from the kinetic term. Okay? There's a very important kernel here in front of the quadratic derivative term, which has the form written here. It's essentially, it's a natural object in a non-abelian gauge theory. It's proportional to the covariant derivative times del bar inverse, as it turns out.
Okay. Did you see some simplification that happens in the larger unit to this Hamiltonian?
Well, this is, everything that I've said up to now is apparently not all that any value of any.
But does the larger unit amount to get rid of this F G term? Because there's no CA on the finding. So it becomes.
Oh, yeah, okay. Everywhere you say CA here, just read that as N. Okay, it's just a quadratic chasm here. It is, for the theory I'm talking about, it is just equal to N. That's a very good question. It looks like this term is down by a factor of 1 over n. You have to be very careful about those sorts of arguments, certainly. And the answer is no. You do need to keep both of these terms carefully. You need to regulate it. You need to keep all of this stuff carefully. This is not where the large n across species is. Okay, so this is exact for any value of n at the moment. Okay. Okay, so what we'd like to do is we'd like to solve the Schrodinger equation for, I'll concentrate here on the vacuum wave functional, so here's the Schrodinger equation. We want to solve for psi naught. And as I said, whatever we write down, any physical thing like the ground state wave function we write down should be both gauge invariant as well as holomorphically invariant. Again, since I'm using gauge invariant variables, gauge invariance isn't an issue, but I do have to pay careful attention to holomorphic invariance. And so what we do is we look around for some nice variables in which we can write the wave functional as a function of. Okay? Sort of, we look for things that we can multiply together and take traces of, all of these things transform in a nice way under holomorphic transformations, and we very easily get invariance in that way. So it turns out that, remember J, the variable J transformed as a connection under the holomorphic transformation, but if you take del bar J, that simply conjugates, as I wrote over here, simply conjugates by H under a holomorphic transformation. The nonlinear term in the transformation of J is purely holomorphic, so when I take the del bar derivative, it goes away. And also, there's a covariant, a holomorphic covariant derivative this looks like D minus J. Okay, that also transforms homogeneously. And so these are the basic building blocks for polymorphic invariant functionals. Okay, so those are the things that I'm going to need. And as we'll see, or as I'll try to argue, this variable del bar J plays a very important role. It's apparently, at the end of the day, it's essentially acting like a string oscillator. Or another way to say that, del bar J is really a convenient coordinate to use on the configuration space. Okay, well, J looks, through its definition, J looks like it was a complex variable, but in fact there's what I often refer to as a reality condition, which is analogous to the hermeticity of H. H was hermitian by its definition. And if you define J bar, which is the del bar derivative of H, in this way, you can just compute. You can just show directly that del bar J is in fact the covariant derivative of this J bar, where the covariant derivative is defined there. And as I said, you should think about this as a reality condition. You might say, well, I should formulate a theory in terms of both J and J bar, but anytime I see a J bar, you can think about replacing it in this way. Okay. Now, in addition to holomorphic invariants, of course, if we write down the vacuum wave functional, we should pay close attention to any other symmetries of the theory. So in particular, there are space-time symmetries, rotations, parity, charge conjugation, etc. And the wave functional should be neutral under all of those symmetries. And what that essentially reduces you to is writing the wave functional as a functional of del bar J, which is neutral under everything, as well as a function of this covariant Laplacian. Okay, which the reason I go to a second derivative is that it's spin zero. Okay, what I should have been showing you is in fact how to think about spin and parity, etc. Since I'm taking a lot of time here, I'll go over this very briefly. But when I talk about spin, of course, I just mean the SO2 subgroup, the Lorentz group, and the various fields and derivatives that I've been talking about here have simple quantum numbers. SO2 is, of course, just U1, and so spin here is just a U1 charge. Okay, the parity that I'm talking about, which is the same thing that Tepper talked about, the lattice data, is where we just flip one of the spatial coordinates. Charge conjugation is the usual charge conjugation. And you can work out the action of those symmetries on the fields. Okay? And for example, del bar J, single factor of del bar J, up to conjugation by H, is of negative parity. Whereas delta, this covariant Laplacian that I had previously, has positive parity. And similarly, anytime you see a factor of J that has negative charge conjugation eigenvalue. Okay, so anyway, so that's how we get to this statement that we should construct functionals of these variables. Okay, well, if we go back and think about the parabolic non-familiar Hamiltonian that I wrote down, if we just had the kinetic part in that Hamiltonian, okay, the entire Hamiltonian would involve derivatives with respect to J, then psi equals 1 would in fact be a solution of the Schrodinger equation that limit. And as I said before, with this non-trivial measure, it's also normalizable. Okay. And in fact, you get into this situation precisely in the limit of large g squared. Okay. Well, at any other values of g squared, both the kinetic and the potential terms are present in the Hamiltonian, and so we should take both of them into account. Psi equals 1 will not be a solution of the Schrodinger equation, but what we'll do, motivated by all of these comments, what we'll do is we'll take an ansatz for the vacuum wave functional, which is the exponential of something. And the claim is that the way to think about what the argument of this exponential looks like is that it begins with a term which is quadratic in del bar j, times some non-trivial kernel, which is a function, I lost factor two, I'm sure you don't care. There's some non-trivial kernel here, which is a, you can think of it as a power series in the Laplacian. And in this, in the argument of this exponential, there might be those terms. There are those terms, but there are also additional higher order terms, higher order in powers of del bar j. And we'd like to think about this ansatz for the wave function as a WKB approximation, where this term that we've written explicitly here is the leading sort of semi-classical approximation to the wave function. And in WKB, what you would have is you would write a similar expression where you have a leading term plus terms which are suppressed by additional powers of h bar. And the belief is that in this theory, the thing that plays the role of h bar in this context is just 1 over n. Okay, so to reiterate then, the formalism that Caraballi and Nair developed was valid at any value of n. There's no approximation there. But when we write down the vacuum wave functional, we're going to think about it in terms of a WKB approximation. Okay, where the claim is that this is the leading result in a 1 over n expansion. Yes?
I have a question, because in the Laplacian delta, there is also a j, so there's also 10 d bar j there. So it's not really a truncation in d bar j, because
if
you have delta squared, you have higher order.
What actually happens here is that delta is like the anti commutator of these things. If you consider the commutator instead, you just work it out. This is in fact, it just evaluates the del bar j. Okay. So what I am allowing here, and again the ultimate grounding that we should take is that we follow along and we derive results and we apparently get sensible answers from this, but what appears to be happening here is that we're expanding in powers of commutators and allowing for arbitrary dependence on, term by term, arbitrary dependence of any commutators. Okay, so that's the difference. So K of L does not directly involve LRJ in this sense. Please.
Can you transform that and write that wave function as functionals of functional of the Wilson loops and see what it expresses? Has anybody done that?
No, that certainly not in terms of Wilson loops. One of the things, and we'll see this work in a little bit of detail in a moment, this L bar J variable is in fact a similarity transformation away from the magnetic field, the ordinary magnetic field. Okay, it's up to the similarity transformation involving, I think it's Edenbacher. Okay? And this is this expression is traced. So you could immediately rewrite this as an expression involving B, the magnetic field squared times some non-trivial stuff here. But going further, these variables are not locally related to the ordinary deviations. Rewriting it in terms of the Wilson loops hasn't been done.
So it's sort of roughly with the trace of B, some kernel derivatives times B.
Right. And that actually, people have tried to do that in the past. They just said, I don't know what the gate in the wave function is, just write down everything that you can possibly think of. And indeed, in some sense, this is what they wrote down as a beginning. Now, the novelty here is that we're going to actually be able to solve the Schrodinger equation term by term in a certain sense and determine what this kernel K is. And as we'll see, it has a very non-trivial form in terms of classical physics. And I think that that program would be very hard to do with the original version.
I mean, Gambini and Rubin and a number of other people made lattice formulations with the wave functions and functional with Wilson groups and numerically got expression for the bound state.
Right.
In 2+1, so it'd be interesting to.
Yeah, I would, yeah. I haven't done that personally.
As you were saying, you basically only transquadratic in J, right?
Don't worry.
Would you lose anything if you just expand the exponent and just write it 1 minus this integral without the exponent and just do everything that you gave in the paper? I mean, if you say that there are dots there, then I can just do Taylor series expansion and write it as a polynomial 1 minus.
Right. Well, again, the claim is that it's more than just that. That the things in the dot dot dots are actually suppressed by 1/n. So we're keeping, and you know, it's on the next transparency, of course. But if we're keeping things that are going to contribute to the Schrodinger equation at leading order, and so. You know, I don't know what to say. I mean, I could expand this, yes.
But you're making a little bit implicit assumptions that, for example, you keep some sort of, this is probably related.
I completely agree, we're making implicit assumptions, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. What I'm saying is that's related to Lorentz statement, that you, on one hand, you are throwing away some of the higher powers of J, and on the other hand, you keep some of them, in particular some of them that assemble you to the exponential.
That's right.
I just wanted to understand.
Yeah. I'm not going to be able to completely satisfy you on this sort of point. I think what I'm saying here about the WKD approximation is correct, and it does make sense to talk about this wave functional that I enriched as a good approximation to the true wave functional. Later on, when we talk about correlation functions, this non-trivial dependence on J is going to come back.
You're
going to go get into it. Yes. Again, there are these. I'm hiding from view any regularization, ordering issues, things like
ordering
that.
Default.
Yeah. It's. There are. Of course, everything is divergent. There are, you know, there's subtractions that you have to do, sort of a normal ordering process that you need to do. So
to continue on this question, is it, in your answer, is that clear that 1/3 is 1/n compared to the other, like the anti-commutative theory is 1/n compared to the commutative, so that this is really
It's not, well.
This amount that you're in mind.
Okay, well, let me go to the next transparency, show you the solution, and then I'll try to argue precisely how I think this is working. What you said is not the right way to say it. Okay, where was it? Okay, so. So hopefully this will help. But okay, so we write down the Schrodinger equation, given the ansatz that we had. We know what the Karabalian-Meyer Hamiltonian looks like, and we just compute. Now again, as I've said several times, you have to be careful about this computation. In order to get a fully covariant answer, you have to regulate properly and work things out carefully. But the idea here is that we act with the Hamiltonian on psi. Psi is an exponential of something. And so when we act, we're going to pull down stuff in front of the exponential. And we're going to organize it by powers of del bar j, the thing in front of the exponential. Okay. First of all, there will be stuff which is of zeroth order in del bar j, which you can interpret, if you like, you should interpret it as the vacuum. It's something, and I'm not terribly interested in it. In fact, we confuse a lot of people in our short paper by just saying we were solving h psi equals zero, and that's not really what we meant. We meant in this sense there is some vacuum energy, but it's just some numerical value, and all of the masses of theory, of course, measured with respect to that vacuum energy anyway. Okay, so continuing along, the next term that arises is quadratic in del bar j, and I've just written it here as del bar j times some factor which I call r del bar j, and we compute what r is, more than a second, and then there's another ellipsis here which contains terms which are of higher order in del bar j. There would be two sources of those of such terms. One source would be higher order terms in the exponential of the wave function, which I didn't write. And also, when you work it out carefully, there are contributions here which come from in the computation of R, we get some expression plus terms which involve del bar j, and consequently, of course, correspond to these higher order terms. Now, the point about 1 over n corrections is that, at least formally, when I look at all of these expressions that occur here, they seem to be suppressed by a 1 over n compared to these terms. Okay. So I think that's the cleanest way that we can say this at this point. Okay, so now what is this r? Well, you compute it, in the box here I've given you a formula for this r, and this is a very formal expression. But what happened here is that, well, for example, the 1 here is easy to see. That came actually from the potential term, because that just gives you a del bar j, del bar j, which is what the potential term looked like. And all these other terms come from the kinetic terms, and they have various sources. Del J acting on various parts of the wave function. And in fact, Kerbal and Nayer tried to do something like this in the past, but it turns out that, at least my interpretation of what they did, was that the wave function that they took was not really holomorphically invariant, and they in fact missed essentially this term here. Okay. So what we did here is there's some computation, some regulated computation that we did, and then we got a result and we rewrote it formally as a derivative with respect to this variable L that K depends on. Okay, so the idea here is that we write down Schrodinger's equation, we get some vacuum energy, and then we get some stuff which does not look like vacuum energy, and we just say, well, we can solve the Schrodinger equation if we set this R to 0. Okay? So that's the origin of this. And so if we can solve this equation, then we will have solved the Schrodinger equation in this order. Okay, well, this is a differential equation that's written in this formal expression. And it's a differential equation of the so-called Kertai type. Okay. And you can solve it. You can see that it's a nonlinear equation. But it turns out that it's not so bad. There's a redefinition of variables that you can do, and I'll show you that on the next transparency. But we should solve this equation subject to certain boundary conditions. And I didn't really touch on this yet. But this kernel K should have asymptotics which correspond to, remember that L here is essentially K squared over M squared. Okay, so L in momentum space goes like K squared. So going to small values of L is like going to low momentum. And that's the confining region. And in fact, the right answer is that K should go to a constant, to 1, and that low L regime. So you can think of that as a boundary condition, if you like, for this differential equation. Or also, if you went to the large momentum regime, you should see a K of L which was consistent with asymptotic freedom. In that limit, you should be able to think of this wave functional as the wave functional of free equivalence. Okay? And I didn't write down any details here, but what happens if you do some redefinitions you find that you can massage this Riccati equation into a Bessel equation, and the solution is formally a ratio of Bessel functions. Okay, so this is a very non-trivial function because it has zeros and poles all over the place.
You're imposing this boundary condition that it's confining in the infrared.
Yes.
Didn't you want to derive that it's confining, or?
Well,
I mean,
okay.
Could I impose other boundary conditions which would make the theory completely different? Or?
Well, okay. I think the better way to say this is that there are two solutions. As I said, you can massage this into a Bessel equation. There are two solutions. One involves J's, one involves these. We're going to be calling them Y. Bessel functions in the second coming. And those guys blow up at low momentum. Okay. That, well, so what we say is that's not the solution that is called for here. The physics of that solution, I'm not sure.
If it's not normalizable, then you're done.
Maybe it's a signature that it's not a consistent truncation to a constant G.
Well, it's a different question. Maybe the other solution is it, if it's not normalizable, then you're done.
Right. Because you wouldn't expect it to be normalizable.
Like the wave function, corresponding to that solution is in fact normalizable.
Right.
So that's the only physical solution.
And the last time we hear it, can you compute using time and diagrams?
V what?
Large L.
Well, it goes over to a form which looks like a kernel would have come from frequent ones. It's just related to the propagator of frequent ones.
So the kernel that blows up,
that's what we're matching on.
So the one that blows up a small panel would then give you the right asymptotic behavior. Because that's really the question.
Okay, that'll be awesome. Yeah, what you're saying is it's enough to look at large moment.
Well, that was the boundary condition of left.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Which would something that you can independently compute.
Right. Okay. If that's the case, then yeah, then it's completely clear. But I think what Laurent is saying is also true. Is that
like if you look at this function, it has ghosts, for instance.
Yeah. If we go back to the, remember I said that psi equals 1 was normalizable in this measure. Of course, because the Hamiltonian is a second order differential operator, in the same regime where psi equals 1 was a solution of the Schrodinger equation, there's another solution, which is, it goes something like e to the s Wessonian width, in fact, with some coefficient. And that in fact, is non-normalizable. So I think you're probably right. You can think of this second solution as sort of analogous to that non-normalizable solution. Okay, so this is the main result in that the claim is that the vacuum wave functional has this approximate form, and we have a very non-trivial kernel, which is written as the ratio of Bessel functions here for. Okay, so as I said, one of the features of this kernel is that if you go to the low momentum limit, it becomes one. It's one, and as we said before, del bar J is a similarity transformation away from the magnetic field, B. And so in that limit, this just looks like the trace of B squared. Okay? And this argument here, in fact, goes back to Caravalli and Nair. What they did is they just said, they pulled out the string tension by this line of argument. They just said in the low momentum limit, the wave functional looks like e to the minus trace B squared. And if you think about the corresponding path integral, that looks like you just have two-dimensional Yang-Mills theory, effectively. And so if you worked out the expectation value of the spatial Wilson loop, you can use the reasoning of two-dimensional Yang-Mills theory and just derive the standard result that you get area law behavior, and you read off from that computation what the string tension is, and here it is. It turns out to be g squared n and some factor. And this agrees, in fact, very well with lattice studies, etc.
What do you mean that it's consistent?
What did I say?
The last.
Here? Oh, okay. So instead of taking, I've said this several times already, instead of going to the small L limit, what happens is, yeah, here it is up here. What happens is that at large momentum, K goes to essentially 1 over P. And so this looks like B times 1 over P times B. And if you think about it,
That's the free ground state limit.
That's what I'm trying to say. So the claim is that the nice feature that this wave function has is it knows about asymptotic freedoms. It's sitting there at large momentum, apparently. And at low momentum, it seems to be consistent with freedom.
Yes.
Okay. Now, so of course, the ground state is just one state in the theory. We would like to also talk about excited states and derive their masses. One way that you might imagine doing that is by trying to write down excited state wave functionals and solve the Schrödinger equation. Okay, in fact, that's the path that Karabali and Nair originally tried to take, although they didn't get the ground state wave functional correct. I think it's an interesting question. You could try to do that sort of thing. Instead, what we did is we pulled out the masses of gauge invariant states by looking at two-point correlators of some operators, certain space-time quantums. By the way, I'm really over time. Is that a problem? It doesn't bother me, but there's only a few more. So the idea is that we want to compute two-point correlation functions and take the large distance limit. And in such a limit, you would expect, you'd expect to see single particle poles. They turn out to have this functional form. And there would be a sum of exponentials where the argument of the exponential tells you the mass of these states. Okay, I already told you how you classify space-time quantum numbers, and so we can just start writing down operators of fixed JPC quantum numbers. The simplest thing that you can imagine is just trace of del bar j, and if you follow the rules that I told you 10 transparencies ago, you see that this is a 0++ operator. And so if we compute this correlation function, we expect to see 0++ states propagating across this this correlation function. Okay, so how do we compute these correlation functions? Well, we know the idea is think about this as a vacuum correlator, and so we can write this correlation function using the vacuum wave functional. And this is a form familiar from ordinary quantum mechanics, but now we have to remember that we have this measure, and we just have to try to compute what this quantity is. Now, so one way that you might try to do this, which we haven't yet had the strength to do, is to think about this as a Wessonino-Witten theory, and just go ahead, this is some CFT computation that I guess, at least by some analytic continuation or something, you could imagine doing. Instead, what we did is we guessed, and then came back and tried to convince ourselves that the results that we got, which are very good, actually make some sort of sense. So the idea is that you should really think about, as I said, we have, we've written the wave functional as a function of these two variables, but the way to think about this really is to think about del bar j as the variable. And to try to, so we wanted to think, we want to think about the path integral here is really an integral over this del bar j variable. Okay? Now, we're going to make an approximation, which is we're going to think about we're going to rewrite this vacuum wave functional using the expression that we have, but we're going to, everywhere that we have k, we'll just replace it by the corresponding function of momentum and proceed. Okay. There's a, presumably there's a large n approximation in this statement as well. Okay, but let me just go ahead with that. And if you, anyway, if you play with the measure and try to convert from h to j variables, you find that there's a determinant factor which essentially absorbs this Wessonian-Witten factor. And you get an integral which at least formally looks like just a free, because again, because the vacuum wave function was Gaussian in the Delmar J variables, it essentially just looks like a free correlator. Okay, so if I take a correlator of an operator like this, it's essentially what happens is that you just, it's just like Witt contractions of Delmar J. Every time you have a Witt contraction, you get a factor of K inverse. Okay, so for the 0 plus plus states, that line of reasoning leads to this two-point correlator going like K inverse squared. Okay, and we can work out what this, and so this is in position space, of course. I want to separate these x and y from each other and look at this formula asymptotically. So what we need to do is Fourier transform the expression that we had for k, which is this ratio of Bessel functions. So you can go ahead and do that and look at it asymptotically. And what you find is that asymptotically, this k inverse can be written as 1 over the square root of x minus y times the sum of exponentials. This is just a formula that you'll find in Gramsci and Richet for, you know, so like a Bessel function identity, if you like. And these m's of n's up to a factor of n over 2 are the zeros of the second Bessel function. Okay, so the gamma 2 comma n here are the is the nth zero of the Bessel function. And so, okay, so this k inverse has been, in coordinate space, has been rewritten in this way. And if we look then at this correlator, we just find, indeed, that it has this single pole form with masses which are just given as sums of zeros of Bessel functions. Okay, that sounds completely crazy. But it turns out, as I showed you, that it works very well. Okay? You can go and look up the zeros of the Bessel functions and write them out. So this is what we did in these tables that I showed you before. And as we said, the numbers, well, okay, so the zero minus minus states come from looking at a different operator with the correct space-time quantum numbers, but it's a similar sort of analysis that you generate. You generate numbers in a similar sort of way. Okay, well, I said most of these things, so we'll deal with the time. I'll just go ahead. And I want to finish the talk with just a few comments. One of the natural things to do, one of the natural things to ask, of course, is, well, you know, do your states form themselves into nice Reggie trajectories? And the answer apparently is yes. Of course, you know, Reggie trajectories, of course, are, you know, what you do is you plot J versus M squared. And you just put a dot on the graph every time you have a state for that given quantum number. So in order to do this, we have to work hard and generate masses for all kinds of states with higher and higher spin. And in principle, you can do that. We've begun to do that. And it seems that it's working quite well. You get a bunch of data, and you can certainly draw a series of straight lines through them. Okay, so what I've shown you in this plot here is just a representative. I think this is the lowest line state that we found. Okay, if you want to compare this to the lattice data, let me just refer back to that. As I mentioned when I first showed you the lattice data, they have lots of data for SU2, lots of spin states. So if you thought 2 was close to infinity, you could plot all of those and see whether they're in regular trajectories. That, but then the problem with the lattice data is that you, as you go up in n, you get fewer and fewer states that they can separate. And so, you know, comparing the slopes or, you know, whatever to the lattice data isn't feasible yet. I hope that this will generate more lattice work and we can compare more carefully. Okay, let me also make some comments on the would-be QCD string, because I think there is some additional extra very interesting structure in the spectrum that we've worked out, which is that it, which comes about by noting that the Bessel functions that we talked about, of course, are essentially sinusoidal, right? They're essentially sinusoidal functions damped away. And at least if you go far out away from the origin, the zeros become separated essentially by pi. You know, they're not exactly separated by pi, but it's fairly close. There's some formula which I think I got wrong here. I think it's for large values of n, I think it asymptotes to pi times n plus, I think it's maybe 3/4. But anyway, something like that. But if you go one to the next, they're closely, it's close to being separated by pi. So what does that mean? Well, if I go out to some high level, to some high mass level, and here I'm just thinking of the 0 plus plus states that we talked about. So here, I suppose you go to the sixth mass level, which what I mean by that is a state, for example, that you might have gotten by taking the first 0 and adding it to the fifth 0. Well, because of these approximate degeneracies, these states that we find have approximate degeneracies. There's another state that you would have gotten from m2 plus m4. There's another state that you would have gotten by m3 plus m3. And these are as I said, are approximately degenerate because of the properties of the zeros of these Bessel functions. And furthermore, as I go very far up in mass level, these degeneracies get better and better. Okay. So what happens here, and so as I said, this was for the 0 plus plus states, but similar statements are true for any other state in the theory. What's happening here is the spectrum is organizing into bands, which are, maybe I should draw that. The spectrum is organizing itself into bands which are well separated, and there are approximately degenerate states at each, at what in string theory we would call them. Okay, and furthermore, you know, if you go up in level, you find many, many higher spin states, depending on what level you're at. Okay, so if we do a preliminary, it turns out if we do a preliminary counting of how many states you have at a given level, it appears that you're getting approximately a Hagedorn spectrum of states. Okay, when you add up all of the different spins that you can have at a different level, at a different level. As I said, the degeneracies of these bands is better and better as you go up higher up in level. And of course, if we compare, so what I want to claim is that this is a basic manifestation of the QCD string. The spectrum is organized into a structure that's very reminiscent of this free string. At high level, the degeneracy is very good, and it looks a lot like the free string spectrum. But as we go down near the bottom, you start to see this extra structure, which is telling you that this is not really, it's not the free string, but it's something else. So I don't have at this point any worldsheet formulation of this string theory, nor am I even sure that there should be one. But at least there are, it appears that there are manifestations of the QCD string in the spectrum. Okay, so let me finish up by giving you some outlook on this work. So one of the things that we need to do, of course, you know, beyond finishing the promised long version of this paper, is to work out more carefully all of the states, particularly the higher, some higher spin states, low line and higher spin states. And you can, I think it's certainly interesting to ask about finite end effects. You might say, well, you know, you might ask me, can I compute the width of some state? And the answer is No, but you know, I think that's an interesting, potentially interesting program. You know, it certainly would be nice to have more lattice simulations at this point. Okay. Now, there are also some generalizations of this theory that we hope to do. One of them is to add fermions to the theory. Okay. And it turns out, this hasn't been written down by anyone, so don't tell anybody, but it turns out that it's fairly easy to add fundamental fermions to this formulation, and I believe that we should be able to work through, well, we can certainly work through the Kerr-Hawley-Nyer parameterization. The hope is that we can demonstrate some very physical features of such a theory. We'd like to demonstrate that these quarks are confined, and we'd like to compute the Meson spectrum, and compare to whatever data there is out there. Everybody also asked me about one of the three plus one Yang mills. This is the $1 million question. And the answer that I'm going to give in public is that it's not clear that this can be handled rigorously by an extension of the formalism that we have here. This is, you know, this change of variables is certainly tied to two dimensions. For example, you know, it's important in the structure that you can give two spatial dimensions a complex structure, and it's all very nice from that point of view, but if you go to 3+1, you certainly lose that. But it's certainly worth a try to go along that direction. And there are several things that we have in mind here. One thing that we have done is sort of a back of the envelope calculation. The idea is just to, you know, use the results that we got in 2+1 and try to argue along the lines of, you know, what changes would there be in the masses if we had one more dimension? So that we can sort of argue that there are perhaps numerical factors that should come into play. And that sounds all very messy and certainly not rigorous, but the amazing thing is that when you do that, the results seem to agree fairly well for the flux states.
Does that mean that the spacing is the same?
The predictions of the so-called predictions of the mass. So one of the problems is that, again, I'm not a lattice person, so I don't really know, but I'm told that the 2+1 lattice simulations are very good. The 3+1 simulations are of blue ball states are much worse. So I'm not sure how much to read into this. But anyway, that's encouraging. And we're also playing around with some similar sorts of parameterizations that might more directly get at 3+1. So let me stop there. Again, I'm sorry.
So, did you have a chance to look at the Hagedorn Bertrand and how big it is compared to string action?
No. What I was telling you about the QCD string is something that I realized literally a year or two ago. Haven't looked at that. I should say that one of my collaborators, Alexander Yolnikov, has looked at some generalizations of this theory on which would be applicable to finite temperature. So he's trying to be real finite temperature facts. But there's no, he did not look, I mean, that's unpublished, and he did not look specifically at finite temperature. But obviously, that's a good point.
This method works for the it's a welcome quantum particle quantum number. For example, the instant with this method still work.
Say again?
I mean, if this for the method welcome kind of quantum particle welcome, for example, if that instant with this.
So okay, so you want me to formulate on spatial background where there's a non-trivial instant support?
Yeah,
is that the question?
Yeah, I see.
That's actually very similar to the answer I just gave. In fact, in that, in So what Alexander did is he actually formulated on a spatial torus, and then you have to worry about large gauge transformations and all that. So there's the beginnings of trying to answer questions like that.
But in this case, maybe the wave function will get some contribution from the time of the path.
Well, right. Topological aspects of this, I certainly would like to understand in more detail. I don't have much to say on that. But there's not a lot of lore out there that we would like to match onto or compare to, and that's one thing that we want to answer even now. Too many things to do all at once. So. Anything else?
Any more questions? Thanks for all the things.